Wake up with the news and information you can trust. This is the Andy Griffin Show on News Radio 890, 92.5 KDXU, Southern Utah's News Talk Leader.
Hey, thanks everybody for tuning in to KDXU this morning. I am honored to be joined in studio today by Representative Celeste Malloy, Republican, big R, Utah, all that stuff and everything. We just know her, Celeste. She likes to hang out with us. I appreciate you being here, Celeste. Thank you so much.
It's good to be here this morning.
You look fantastic. You look bright-eyed and like, oh, yeah, the world is my oyster and all that stuff. And you feeling good?
Well, when you have this kind of weather in St. George, it's hard not to feel in a happy mood.
Good point. That's it. Absolutely. It is gorgeous. And we have, of course, a great view here in the studio, looking out at the Red Rocks and everything.
Yeah.
And I assume you just drove down from Cedar?
I did this morning.
Well, I appreciate you coming down this far. It's really, really awesome of you to do that. So my parents lived in New Harmony for many years, 14 years or something, and we drove back and forth to New Harmony.
Yeah.
I can't tell you how many times. And, of course, I've had kids go to SUU, and we lived in Cedar for a year. And so I know that highway well.
Me too.
Yes, very well.
And this time of year, it's not treacherous to drive. So.
That's true. But one time I did a basketball game up at Cedar High School, and one of the St. George teams was playing Cedar High. I went in, no snow. I came out, there was like a foot of snow on top of my car, and it was blizzard conditions all the way home. And I'm like, tell whoever's in charge of the sports scheduling, I'm not doing games at Cedar anymore. This sucks. you know what? They also don't have 110 in the summertime, too, in Cedar City. So
we really do get the best of both worlds in southern Utah, because you get the snow in Cedar City without an inversion, where it's sunny all winter, but you can do winter sports. And then St. George, where you can be water skiing the same day you can ski in Cedar City.
Yeah. Snow skiing and water skiing at the same time, or the same day. Yeah. Just got a text. This is, we're getting rolling here. So can we talk about the big interstellar object that's hurtling toward us at a very fast pace? Can you ask Celeste Malloy what she thinks about that? Because it's not being talked about by the government or media very much.
Unfortunately, I guess because it's not being talked about, I don't know what we're talking about.
I don't either. I know it was 3 days ago a meteor came by. They said it was the size of a skyscraper and missed the Earth by, I don't know, it was like 10 million miles, which isn't very far, I guess. But it's relatively close. I don't know how far it was. But
I don't know what the size of a skyscraper means either. It reminds me of all those memes about how Americans will measure in anything except the metric system.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. It's not 300 meters. It's the size of a large building, apparently.
Yes. Yeah.
That's kind of how we are. Now, you are a lawyer.
Yes.
Grew up and with a history of first of all law, but also really being knowledgeable about lands and so on. That's kind of your thing, right?
Yeah.
So, do other people say I'm in New York or LA? Do they have a concept of some of the land issues that Utah has at all?
No, and it's hard to explain. Even the concept of like 100,000 acres is pretty hard to understand if you're from New York.
Right.
And a lot of eastern states have a lot of agriculture. You know, maybe 100,000 acres isn't so hard to understand. But what a 1.6 million acre national monument looks like, just extremely hard for someone to fathom. Even when you live here, you know, the polygon on a map doesn't look that big. But if you get up to like Powell Point and look out over the monument and you realize it's, you know, enormous.
That's pretty big.
Yeah.
That's pretty big. And I think, especially the city folk, I hate to sound like a old country boy, but if you live in New York City or you live in Chicago or Boston, one of those places, they have no concept of this kind of thing, of public lands and things like that. And so how do you then, as a representative from the state of Utah who specializes in this kind of thing, how do you help them understand? You use that whole American measurement thing, say, well, it's the size of, you know.
Actually, we do a lot. Yes. It's funny. I was in Alaska a few weeks ago with the Natural Resources Committee, and in order to explain things up there, they're like, this is the size of Connecticut. This is the size of New Jersey. Mm-hmm. But we do that a lot, too.
Yeah.
You know, this is bigger than Rhode Island. Otherwise, the numbers just get so big. It's like when you're talking about trillions of dollars. It's hard for most people to understand. Like, the difference between 1.6 $3 trillion and $1.4 trillion is a huge difference, but it doesn't sound big when you're saying $1.3 or $1.4.
Yeah. Even though that's what it looks like $100 billion or something like that, the difference between the two. So it is a big number. You're right. Clarification on this object. On a 3I, Atlas is the largest interstellar object recorded with an estimated nucleus size of between 440 meters and 5.6 kilometers. It is traveling extreme fast, about 210,000 kilometers an hour, making the fastest known solar system visitor. Okay. You learned something today.
Well, whoever typed that is willing to measure in metric. We at least learned that.
Yes, thankful. Thankful for that. I remember, now I'm a little older than you, but I remember in school, I think it was Jimmy Carter had absolutely said, U.S. is going metric. We are going to convert. Everybody's going to learn it. And they taught it. And I remember I was in elementary school. They taught everybody was, oh, we're going to learn this. And it just fell flat. We didn't. And now it creeps in a little bit. You buy a 2-liter soda, right?
Sure.
Or you have, I'm trying to think, what else do we do in meter? I guess they have, is it swimming still uses yards and track and field uses meters? I think that's what that is.
Yeah.
So it is creeping in a little bit here and there, but I think there are certain concepts that Americans are never going to get.
We think in miles and pounds.
Yeah.
I just don't know that we can change that.
I think there's only two countries in the world that do that right now, England and us, right?
No.
Yeah. So, it's okay.
When you're the world superpower, you could measure in anything you want.
Absolutely. All right, I want to talk a little bit about a couple of things, and I'm going to call it my little cheat sheet here so that I can remember. Oh, you sponsored a bill. You were talking about a bill, Wildland Firefighter Hazard Pay, and I did a story on it the other day. Basically, these guys are getting paid hazard pay to fight the fires, but to train and get ready to fight the fires, they're not getting that.
Yeah.
Is that right?
And it's not just that. So, you know, hot shots, they have to jump out of airplanes.
Right.
And it's dangerous. And they get paid if they do it in a fire, but they don't get paid if they're doing it to train. It's still dangerous. So we fix that. But also, firefighters in general get paid hazard pay on a wildfire, but not on a prescribed burn. So we keep talking about active forest management and we have to do a better job of reducing fuels. But there's an incentive problem here with firefighters where they make more money fighting wildfires than they do controlling the fuels that cause wildfires.
Right.
If they're on a controlled burn, a prescribed burn, they get paid their regular pay. If they wait until they get a lightning strike, then they get hazard pay.
So there's no motivation for them to go to a prescribed burn, basically.
Yeah, and so this actually came from talking with fire managers and firefighters. My chief of staff was a wildland firefighter, and we're in Utah talking about why is it that we know these fuel loads need to be reduced and you have a prescribed burn plan, but we can't get the burn plan done. And now we just had a lightning strike and the whole thing's burning and it's going to cost millions and millions of dollars to contain this, when if we'd have done it in the winter, we could have burned it off safely. And this was one of the problems, is that the pay is different.
Do you feel like that the move to reduce the fuels to make things better than they've been is underway now that we have a different president?
No, I absolutely do. In fact, there were county commissioners, not from Washington County, but from other counties in the second district in Washington, D.C. a few weeks ago. And I went with them to meet with Chief Schultz, the chief of the Forest Service. Mm-hmm. And they went in with this long list of things they wanted to talk to him about. And 10 minutes into the meeting, he'd already agreed to everything they were asking for, including this, you know, more active management, and the counties and the state being able to have a larger voice in planning that management and saying what they wanted to have happen. And, you know, we had the Monroe fire this summer that they had been doing active management in that area, and the fire started in the last segment they hadn't done yet and ended up being a lot worse It ended up being a lot worse because it started there than if it had started anywhere else in that area. But with that fresh on the Forest Service's mind, they went and talked to the chief, and he comes from the timber world, and he agreed. You know, counties and states should have a larger role. The administration is going to sign contracts with the state of Utah and the counties so that they can manage some of these things that impact them on a daily basis in a way that somebody in Washington, D.C. just isn't invested in active forest management, making sure we reduce the fuel loads, making sure we're planning for long-term viability of grazing on the forests. making sure that people's cabins are safe.
Yeah.
The locals just have such a stake in how that's managed. And he agreed that they should have a bigger voice. And that is a breath of fresh air.
Absolutely. They maybe didn't expect it to be as easy. I guess easy is not the right word. But.
No, that is the exact right word. I think they expected to go in there. They knew this was a friendly administration, and the Biden administration hadn't been friendly to it. Right. But I think they expected to have to go in and spend a lot of time explaining to the chief of the Forest Service the concepts that I just said.
Yeah.
What a big stake they have in how the forest managed, and why the locals are better at it, and why they felt like they should have a bigger voice in how their own counties manage than somebody in Washington, D.C. And it was like they were ready, you know, for a big battle, and the other side showed up and agreed. And so there was
there was a story on the wire yesterday about the things that killed the life expectancy, and it said quickly climbing the chart was inhalation of wildfire smoke in the West.
Really?
It's interesting that as you bring this up, I'm like, you know, that's one of those things they predict that's going to make it into the top 10 if things don't change, because it's such a big deal. I mean, you know, there are people who were lifelong, you know, never smoked a cigarette in their lives, but they're breathing, you know, they live by a forest fire, and it ends up with the secondhand smoke from a fire. It actually ends up giving them cancer. So, you know, to have the administration actually be agreeable and say, you know what, we've got to do something about this, that's important.
Yeah. The other thing they're really willing to work with us on is not just burning off the fuel loads to get rid of them, but turning them into products, creating jobs in Utah where we're taking forest products off of our forests. So we don't have, especially in this part of the state, the big timber like Oregon and Washington and Idaho do. So the Forest Service, you know, wood product sales here need to look a little different. And it's been a struggle getting the Forest Service to work with the industry to make what they're doing for timber sales match up with what the market here needs. And I'm seeing huge strides in that right now, where maybe we're going to have some smaller sawmills, not the big ones like they have in Montana, but sawmills here, and the ability to process this small diameter timber and the wood products that are growing on our federal land and create an economy instead of a hazard.
Do you feel like this is kind of related to the topic? Do you feel like you have these projects? This is one of your projects that's very important to you that you're working on.
I
talked with Gil Onquist the other day. He's the county commissioner, and you know Gil.
Yeah.
And he said, I asked him how much longer he's going to, you know, be in public office. And he says, well, I got some projects I want to make sure to see through to the end. Do you feel like with your job, you have all these projects that you're trying to see through, but Your term as a congressman is so short, and you have to run again every other year and all that stuff. Do you feel like that's a really tough thing for you? Like you never get to see the end of a story almost?
I mean, that can be frustrating. We've had a lot of success so far. I mean, I've had four bills signed into law in less than 2 years. That's pretty rare. But then there are also things like the Northern Corridor that I worked on as a county attorney and as a staffer and now as a member. And those things are frustrating, although I think we're going to get a resolution to that.
I was going to ask, any news on that?
Yeah, we are going in the right direction.
Okay.
But that is one of the toughest things about working in federal policy. And I tell young people that all the time. They come in with all this energy and all this momentum, and it's great. But I tell them, you're playing a long game here. Federal policy doesn't turn on a dime. So if you want to come in and fix everything in 6 months or a year, you're just going to frustrate yourself and burn out. You've got to think in longer terms than that to get wins. But then the impacts of it are so long term as well when you do get a win.
It's not like you're in the Senate and you get 6 years, right?
No.
You got to act quick.
Yeah.
Strike while the iron's hot, so to speak. All right. We're talking again with Representative Celeste Malloy here on the Andy Griffin Show, and she's got her Dr. Pepper. I've got mine over here, too. Don't tell my wife.
I mean, it is almost 9:30 a.m. It's time.
It's midday, if you ask me. Anyway, and she gets to spend a lot of time in Washington, D.C. As part of her job. Tell us a little bit about that experience of kind of being split between two worlds right now, being Celeste here at home and being, you know, one of the movers and shakers in Washington, D.C. the rest of the time.
It just means I spend a lot of time in airports, more time than a normal human spends in an airport. Yeah. So I know where the good food is and where the bathrooms that are the least likely to be crowded are.
Yeah, the cleanest rooms,
And I've gotten really good at sleeping on airplanes.
Have you?
Yeah. People tell me all the time that they can't sleep on planes.
No,
and
I can't.
I remember that I used to not sleep on planes, and now I can sleep through the majority of a flight. I rarely hear that video that they play before you take off.
You're already
out.
Wow. I'm impressed. I can't do that. Can you sleep in air? Do you have layovers often?
Can you
sleep in airports?
I try not to sleep in the airport because I don't want to miss my connection. Mm. The thing about sleeping on a plane is it's going to land and they're going to notice that you're not getting off.
Eventually. Somebody's going to wake you up.
Yeah.
We need to do something about the food, though. used to be you could get a halfway decent meal on an airplane. Not anymore. It's pretty bad. I did, we flew, I want to say Air France. I don't know. But when we flew back from Europe, the food was actually pretty good on the overnight flight there. But
If you're on a really long flight, they usually have good food.
Yeah. Okay. What were some of the other topics? I'm going to see if I can. Yesterday we did a story about the Colorado River and water. And, you know, I talked with Zach Renstrom, and you know Zach very well.
I do.
And he said, you know, one of the things we don't think about with if the Lake Mead and Lake Powell get low enough, those are two major producers of hydroelectricity. I mean, they bring electricity to millions and millions of people. He said, if the lakes get low enough, we lose that, too. And people don't even think about that. Yeah, we know we're low on water. Mm-hmm. But if you're low on water, you end up being low on electricity, so to speak, or you have to get the electricity from somewhere else, which could be a major factor, I guess.
Yeah. No, if you think about what the populations of the basin states were before those dams and what they are now, other than air conditioning, what's the factor that changed? They produce a lot of affordable electricity. And I would argue that that's what enabled air conditioning to become common.
Yeah.
So we forget sometimes how dependent we are on the water behind those dams to be able to survive in these states. And even 100 years ago when they built the dams and people started filling in out here, I think they didn't realize how big states like Utah and Nevada would get. They knew California was going to grow.
Yeah.
And you can see in the decisions they made and in the conversations they had that they didn't think some of these states would grow as much as they did. It was just something that was hard to predict what the freeway system and air conditioning would do for these western states and how much they'd fill in. And we all just take for granted that we're going to have power and we're going to have water. But those are not givens, and that's part of the reason these states were so sparsely populated at the time. And we have to find solutions to that. There's some things we can't control. How much water falls out of the sky.
That one's
beyond our control for the most part. We can control how far we make every drop go. We can control if we're developing other sources of energy. We can control, you know, the zoning laws and our relationships with the other states. And so all of those things are in play right now. I get asked about Colorado River a lot. A lot of people are concerned. But I think most of them are surprised when they find out that the negotiations on the actual water are between states, not with the federal government right now. And then a lot of the power discussion is federal and not state, which I think surprises a lot of people.
I know Zach was talking yesterday about the fact that we have been fortunate in that we have had a lot of legislators who are very friendly about this water. And in particular, the compact, the agreement that goes back 100 years about who the water belongs to and how much of it. And, and he said, if we didn't have strong legislators like you, we might be in a little bit of trouble because there are a lot of very powerful, very rich people downriver who want that water.
Yeah. No, and math alone in the House makes this tough. California has more representatives in the United States House of Representatives than the other six basin states combined.
Wow.
They are the elephant in the room when Congress is talking about it. But when you have states negotiating, each state has one governor.
Right.
They're negotiating much more as equals. Even when you're talking about the Senate, you know, they each have two senators, and so they're negotiating as equals. But if you want Congress involved, stop and do a little bit of math. And then sit back and let the states negotiate this one.
Yeah, good point. Good point. All right, let's talk budget for just a minute. We got like 3 minutes before the break. I know that's not long enough to talk budget, but every day there's a story on the wire or two or three about we're getting closer and closer to a government shutdown.
We are.
And it's funny, the tables have turned now. You know, you had the Democrats making one accusation before. Now they're the shoes on the other foot.
Yes.
How are we to, as regular everyday citizens, how are we to look at this whole government budget, government funding?
So I'll break it down for you quickly in 2 minutes. I am an appropriator. The Appropriations Committee in the House got all 12 of our bills marked up and out of committee. Three of them have crossed the floor. The other nine are ready. We've done our job and we've done it on time. The Senate's behind us, but they're catching up. We have the votes, barely, in the House to be able to pass appropriations bills on party lines. And we have. In order to buy time for the Senate to catch up so that we can take the Senate appropriations bills, the House appropriations bills, and conference them and reconcile them and get them to the president's desk, we passed a clean 7-week CR. This is what Democrats said they wanted, a clean CR with no riders on it, no ornaments on the Christmas tree is the metaphor that people usually use. And now Democrats in the Senate are balking at it. We passed it out of the House. And so this is firmly, squarely on the shoulders of seven Senate Democrats. If we can't keep the government open, it will be because we couldn't get seven senators to cross over and agree to the funding levels that we are currently at, that Democrats did help us pass. So it's a clean continuing resolution just for 7 weeks to help us have the time to get the regular appropriations bills done, which we're doing. This isn't a dereliction of duty where we're saying we need more time because we didn't do it. And the Democrats are so angry that they don't have power in the White House, the House, or the Senate, that this is it. This is all they've got. They're digging in their heels against their own best interest. And the question is, will they realize before midnight on the 30th that this isn't in their best interest and change their minds? And everybody's watching. There's a lot of ink being spilled, a lot of breath being wasted on talk radio and every podcast and everywhere about what Democrats will do. And we'll all know in a few days.
These are the same people that not that long ago were saying, oh, Republicans have no heart. They won't pass the budget.
And when we cause a shutdown, when there's a shutdown and Republicans get blamed for it, in order to come out of the shutdown, we have to negotiate with Democrats, which means we always end up spending more money. They're not used to this going the other way,
right,
where if they shut it down, in order to reopen, they'll have to negotiate with Republicans who are going to require cuts. And they do not like cuts.
Yeah. Unbelievable. They don't like cuts. We like cuts.
Yeah.
But they don't
bring
like
on
cuts.
The cuts.
Yeah, bring on the cuts. All right, got to get a commercial break in. Talking with Representative Celeste Malloy. We'll be right back.
All the latest news, weather, traffic, and sports. Just like you like them. You're waking up with the Andy Griffin Show on News Radio 890, 92.5 KDXU. Southern Utah's news talk leader.
We are lucky enough here on the Andy Griffin Show to have made good friends with Celeste Malloy. We were there as she went through the election process, and now here she is, the representative of the District 2, the state of Utah, for international government. Celeste, thanks for being here today. Appreciate you.
You're welcome.
You, let's go back 2 weeks ago on what happened with the assassination of Charlie Kirk from a kid that turns out is from like 4 miles that way.
Yeah.
Tell us about your experience of how you found out about how it all came down, because I've told mine on the air, but maybe tell us how you found out about it all.
I was in Washington, D.C. I was sitting in an appropriations committee markup. So there were, a bunch of members of Congress sitting in that room, and my phone started ringing. I started getting texts from people. The first one I got said, are you aware of what just happened in Utah with Charlie Kirk? And I text back, no. And by the time I hit send on that no, I already had about a dozen other texts.
Wow.
And so I turned to one of my colleagues I was sitting next to. She had her iPad there, and I said, can you find anything about what just happened in Utah with Charlie Kirk? And she started typing, and she said, no, I don't know what you're talking about. There's nothing here.
Wow, that early, huh?
But, well, so some of the people who were texting me were there. And so it all started to happen really fast. One of my friends called me. His daughter was there, and he said, do you know what's happening? I can't get answers. She's scared. And so it kind of blew up, I think, for everybody in America. No one expected it. Right. It was, you know, the middle of the day, and the news started coming in fast and furious. And so we're in the markup trying to do the business we're supposed to do, but my phone started to light up. So did everyone else around the table, because even though this happened in Utah, Charlie Kirk is, he started the youth conservative movement. He was the leader of the youth conservative movement. And a lot of the staff that work on Capitol Hill are Turning Point USA kids. That's where they started. Mm-hmm. A lot of the members there knew him really well. I didn't know him personally. I never met him in person. Sorry. And a lot of the, there are a lot of places in this country that people felt like Charlie Kirk belonged to them. And so it felt really personal to people all over the country. And so as the news started to come in, people had a really instant reaction of disbelief, and this cannot be happening.
Right.
And so for the first, you know, half hour, hour, we were getting a lot of conflicting information, and was he still alive? Was he not alive? Was
yeah,
he
we
the
didn't
hospital?
Even know the first little while. Yeah.
No, and in the middle of that, they called votes. So we all had to head down to the floor to vote. And that's where that clip comes from of the Democrats booing the suggestion by a couple of my colleagues that we have a prayer on the floor for Charlie Kirk. There was a moment of silence first. I will say, in fairness, everyone was really reverent through the moment of silence. I don't know that that makes it better, really, but that didn't always get reported on. So everyone was respectful through the moment of silence. Then they asked for prayer. And then the prayer request set off the Democrats. And it was not a beautiful moment in U.S. history. Watching members of Congress on the floor booing the idea and yelling about the idea of having a prayer for someone who had just been assassinated for their political views in the United States of America in broad daylight on a college campus was not one of our best moments. But I think we have had some beautiful moments as a result of it. What happened was not okay. I mean, it was just a murder in broad daylight. There's no way around that. But the way this state and this county have reacted has really warmed my heart. There's a lot of places in the country that I think if it had happened there, there'd have been riots and protests, and it would have turned ugly. And it hasn't really turned ugly here. Our public officials have been calling for prayer and checking on your neighbors and making sure people are okay. And our public has held really well in the face of a lot of scrutiny, a lot of international scrutiny, and a lot of voices sort of calling for people to be more divisive.
Right.
But I think the voices that are calling for calm have won out, and I think that says a lot about who we are here in Utah. It wasn't that people here didn't feel angry. It wasn't that people here didn't feel shocked and upset by what happened.
Hurt, yeah.
But the reaction to it was to check on their neighbors, mourn with people who are mourning, and have more of a constructive response. And I had somebody say to me, I was at Charlie Kirk's memorial on Sunday in Arizona, and when Erica Kirk got up and said that she forgives the young man who pulled the trigger, I mean, it was a powerful moment, even if you read it in print later, even if you saw it on TV later, but in that packed stadium that day, that was an incredibly powerful moment. And somebody said to me that day, I don't know that she could have gotten up and said that if Utah hadn't reacted so well. Wow. If there were riots happening in the street, if everything had gotten ugly, it might have been harder for her to stand up and say that. And maybe Utah created an environment where that was possible. And I don't know if that's true or not, but it is a really high compliment to the people here. And I know it's been really hard on people here in this county, in this town.
Definitely.
To know that the guy who pulled the trigger is one of our own and grew up here. Mm-hmm. And I think people have handled that really well, too.
I wanted to ask you about that. Now, you were there. First of all, I guess before we get into some of the stuff there, tell us about the experience of being in that building when Erica spoke, when President Trump spoke.
No, it was incredible. I'm really glad I was there. It was a good opportunity for the people who loved Charlie Kirk, who loved the movement, who were feeling hurt and lost and angry to get together. There were a lot of speakers, and I've heard some criticism of that there were too many speeches, that too many speeches were about the speaker and not about Charlie. And I think some of that misses the point. We're all grappling here. We haven't had a political assassination like that in a long time in the United States, and nobody really knows how to react. We're all learning how to react to something like that. And getting the Turning Point people in a room and the administration, he was personal friends with the majority of the cabinet, with the president, with the vice president. Getting all those people into a big stadium full of other people who are grappling with this and hearing from some of the leaders of that movement, the leaders of the country, thought leaders, even religious leaders, and working through some of that grief and figuring out how to turn it into something productive. There was a lot of talk of, like, Charlie's legacy isn't going to die.
Right.
And there's a big movement, and it's going to keep going even without him. And Charlie's legacy, a lot of it is having dialogue, not just sitting behind a keyboard and typing angry rhetoric at a disembodied, you know, meme or a name that you don't actually know the person on the other side. He was interacting face to face with people, even when they were talking about things that were uncomfortable. And we've got to get better at that. We have to be able to talk about the uncomfortable things, and not always even with the goal of convincing the other person. We just have to, in a country where our system of government is based on the value of the individual, and that government exists to protect the individual, and that the individual has a voice in government, we have to be able to talk about things that are controversial and on which we disagree. And Charlie Kirk set a really good example of being out with people doing that. And I don't think that's going to die. But I think a lot of the people in that stadium needed to hear that. They needed to come together and agree on that. They needed to see each other and be there together. And it was really powerful for those reasons. And then some of the messages were powerful. We were there for a long time. Yeah. I left my hotel room at 5:30 that morning, and I didn't get home until, or home, I didn't get back to the hotel until about 9 o'clock
night.
We were supposed to be in our seats by 8. I was traveling across Phoenix with Juan Ciscomani, who's a congressman from Tucson, and his family. And it took us 2.5 hours to get from, I Ubered to his hotel and then hopped in his minivan with his family. And it took us 2.5 hours to get to the stadium and into our seats. So we weren't there by 8 when we were supposed to. But it didn't start until 11.
Right.
So they had sort of a Christian rock concert going on between 8 and 11. It started at 11. I think it ended at like 4:30 or 5. So it was a long day. And then we had to get all of those people out of there. I actually did an interview on the news here in Utah on my phone while I was walking through the crowd.
Oh, wow.
Because they couldn't wait any longer and I couldn't get out of there any faster. But there's something to be said for coming together as a community and just being with each other. And Sunday was a great example of that. And it was peaceful, and there were no, you know, legal issues, no violence,
no riots.
It was a beautiful example of what makes us Americans.
And one of the things that you kind of got me reflecting about it, and I think a lot of us don't think about it enough, is who Charlie Kirk was. Remember, here's a guy that started Turning Point USA when he was 18.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned he's good friends with a lot of the cabinet members and the president. Think about that. An 18-year-old who didn't go to college.
Yeah.
His whole point was to try to have dialogue with people. He would have these gigantic rallies.
Yeah.
And almost every speaker that came to the microphone was trying to trick him, was trying to catch him, was trying to get him.
Yeah.
And he handled it with aplomb. I think Charlie Kirk was a genius, personally. Some of the answers, I was like, wow, how does he know all that?
Most people would agree with you. He seemed to have an almost photographic memory and just a huge intellect. And he could have used that to do a lot of things, make a lot of money. He used it to try to convince young people to get involved in government and not disengage. What a blessing that is. Yeah. And he talked about his faith. It wasn't just politics. He spent his time trying to get people to engage in politics and also religion. He was always telling people, you know, to turn to God. And it's not a secret that young adult men are struggling in this country.
Yeah.
And he especially was focused on young adult men. And he would tell them, get married, have a family, take on responsibilities, become part of society, contribute something, you know, rely on God. People don't say that out loud very often anymore, and it's an important message that he was delivering very well.
For the last, as long as I can remember, religious people have been ridiculed on television. You know, if you turn on a sitcom or a drama, if there's it's a crazy Christian, you know, a weird religious person and stuff.
They're kooky and weird and rural, right?
And it's not real. It's not reality.
Yeah.
So, and you're right. Charlie Kirk did a good job of bringing that maybe a little more into the mainstream. I did a show last Friday about keeping the Sabbath day holy, and it's like, wait a minute, you can't talk about that on talk radio. Well, guess what Charlie and Erica Kirk talked about all the time was on Sundays he would turn his phone off, put it in the drawer, and spend the day with his family and his God.
Yep.
And that's what he did. And everybody's like, well, you can't talk about keeping the Sabbath day holy. Well, actually, yeah, we can, and he did, and we will. So
I will admit, though, on Sunday when I got out of the memorial, I did go out to eat.
Yeah.
I had not had food since 5:30 that morning.
Were they selling food at the...
No.
No, there was no food at the place. No. So everybody there was hungry.
Yeah. It was a real religious experience where we were...
Fasting.
I mean, I hadn't planned on fasting, but it turned out that way.
Yeah, a quick weight loss program, I guess.
Yeah.
947 on KDX. You got to get a commercial and we'll be right back.
Wake up with the news and information you can trust. This is the Andy Griffin Show on News Radio 890, 92.5 KDXU, Southern Utah's news talk leader.
All right, we're going to throw a curveball at Celeste Malloy here on the Andy Griffin Show. Celeste, if you could go anywhere in the world for a week's paid vacation, it would be?
Oh, I don't even know.
I know. I curveball, you didn't. We didn't talk about it during the break or anything. I just thought I'd throw it out there.
Probably my own home and sleep in my own bed.
Really? Well, I guess that qualifies, but I was thinking, you know, somewhere like Italy or New Zealand or whatever.
That would be lovely, and I wouldn't hate it, but I get to fly a lot.
Yeah.
And if I had a week where I didn't get on an airplane, and I didn't have to answer my phone, and I could sleep in my own bed and wake up at a normal hour when the sun's up, would be beautiful.
All right. Fair enough. I'll go along with you on that one. I asked Jack Lancaster that earlier this week, and then he turned it back around on me because I didn't expect to be asked back. Because he had said a couple of places, and maybe New Zealand was his. And I was like, I don't know. I guess. I mean, my wife and I love Hawaii, but
I've never been to Hawaii.
You've never been there.
So that's probably what I should have said.
Yeah.
I only have 3 U.S. states left that I haven't been to. And
really?
Hawaii,
okay, you're way ahead of me, but I'm surprised. I mean, Hawaii is usually one of the first ones people get.
Yeah, not me.
So I'm guessing Rhode Island.
No, I've been to Rhode Island.
You've been to Rhode Island.
I have Maine, North Dakota, and Hawaii. So I guess maybe I should have chosen those 3 as my week-long vacation.
Okay, there you go. I think probably my wife's family, her ancestry is from Italy. So I think I would like to go back to where her ancestry is and find out how her grandparents grew up and stuff. So I think that'd be cool.
I have been to Italy, and I did love it. The food is obviously amazing, but the people there are very complimentary.
Yeah,
you know, you walk down the street, and people are like, you have beautiful teeth. I'm like, I walk down the street in St. George. Nobody tells me my teeth are beautiful. I could get used to that.
Celeste, you have beautiful teeth. Thank you. We were talking a little bit about the Charlie Kirk Memorial, and one of the things that Erica Kirk said was that she forgave the young man that did the shooting. And the question I had posed, and I'm not trying to be callous or anything, but her forgiving the shooter, does that mean anything to the left, many of whom say, I don't believe in God, I don't believe religion is real, I don't... When you forgive someone, a pretty religious principle, does that mean anything to them? What do you think?
I think it does. I think it has to. So obviously, I'm coming at this from my own biases, and I'm very religious, and that colors my view of this. But if you watch that clip, even if you weren't there, even if you don't have a lot of context for it, it is not an easy thing for her to say. She is clearly struggling as a human being. 11 days after her husband was very, very publicly executed.
Right.
And the whole world kind of felt the shockwaves from that. And even if you are on the opposite side of Charlie Kirk on everything political, you at some point, seeing that clip, have to realize that these are human beings. These are individual people with their own dreams, their own families, their own futures they were planning for. And for her to be able to stand up there and say, because of my faith in God, because of what I believe in, I'm digging deep here and pulling on everything that I've ever said I believe and putting it into action in a really difficult circumstance, that humanizes the struggle that she's going through. So even if you don't believe in God, even if you are callous enough to have seen that and thought even for a second, maybe he had it coming because he liked to argue with people, that brings back the reality that he was a human being who was shot, and the woman who loves him, who had babies with him, who was planning a future with him, is willing to draw on her beliefs and say, amazing, I forgive him. As Americans, we're all in this together. We don't all have to agree on everything. In fact, disagreement is a good thing. It's part of what makes us Americans. But it doesn't work if we can't see each other as people. If you can't look at another human being and feel some sort of basic level of empathy or sympathy or kinship with them, we've lost something precious and we probably can't save this country. Mm-hmm. But if we want, you know, we're about to have our 250th birthday. If we want to have 250 more years, we have to recognize that we're a government of the people, by the people, for the people. People matter. And right. Shooting people can't be the answer. You can't actually want half of this country to fail and think that the country is going to succeed. So we should be out in the public square having discourse. We should be disagreeing. There's some things we are never going to agree on. The Democrats on the other side of the aisle for me in Washington, D.C., there are some issues I am just never going to agree with them on. But if I stop seeing them as humans, then I can't even engage with them in the debate because
that's true.
I can write them off as, you know, what Erica Kirk did was stand up there and be very, very human in the most amazing way
right.
for the whole world to see. She didn't stand up there and say, you know, that she wanted people to hate the other side. She didn't stand up there and say she hates the other side. She stood there as a woman with very small children who had just lost her husband and said that she forgives the shooter. She didn't tell anyone else how to feel about it. She said right. how she feels about right. it. And if that doesn't make people in this country who even disagree with her feel a little more connected to her and a little more connected to their fellow Americans, then I don't think this country can be saved. But I think it did.
Yeah.
I think watching her do that, there's not a leftist or a liberal in this country who doesn't have a family that they love or someone they admire or believe in something. You had to feel something when you saw that, even if you're skeptical about religion, even if you're skeptical about the right and about Charlie Kirk and about even open displays of religion. It was just a good reminder that at our core, we're all people, we're all Americans, and we actually all have to live here together. If we all start shooting each other, we've tried that before. That was the Civil War.
Yeah.
It didn't go well. We lost more Americans in the Civil War than we have in any other conflict. And at the end of it, we realized we all have to be in it together. And we stayed right. together as a union. And it took a long time to heal those wounds. In fact, some of them probably still aren't healed. So, yes, I think it matters that she stood there and said she forgives Tyler Robinson. I think it matters to people in Utah who are struggling to know how to feel about right. something they're really angry about. But it started here. I think it helps people on the left who don't want to say they agree with Charlie Kirk, but want something they can say about how inappropriate that was. I think it helps people on the left and the right who've forgotten that the people on the other side are people. I think it matters a lot, even if you don't share her religion.
Very well said. I think, you know, in kind of summing up what you said, it was the perfect response
yeah.
to what happened. And we're not going to get Charlie Kirk back. She's not going to get her husband back.
Yeah.
But it was the perfect response for everyone, both sides, looking at it.
And the justice system still has to do what the justice system does. She right. didn't say, I forgive him, therefore he shouldn't be prosecuted. Mm. She can't say that. That he will be prosecuted, that's out of her hands. What she can control is what's in her heart and what she's telling the world. And right. she handled that beautifully.
She really did. It makes, I think in a way also, each one of us reflects, would I be able to do that? And I don't know.
I don't either.
I hope I never have to find out, right?
I hope so, too.
But she did the perfect thing at the perfect moment. So, Celeste, we're out of time. We did it.
It went so quickly.
It goes so fast every time. But first of all, I want to thank you for coming. And second of all, I want to thank you for representing our area well in Washington, D.C. It's important to a lot of us. And by all accounts that I've seen, you're doing a fantastic job. So thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Keep up the good work. We're out of time here on the Andy Griffin Show. I'll be back in tomorrow with Open Line Friday. Look forward to talking to you then.